Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing at 266 Edgware Road in Paddington, W2. One street east of the Blackout Ripper slaughter of Dawes Juney. One street north of the Met Police's shooting of David Martin. Two streets west of the studio where Reg Christie shot some pornographic snaps. And four streets south of Timothy Cotter, the sweet-faced 14-year-old boy who wouldn't harm a fly. Coming soon to Murder Mile. On the north corner of Chapel Street and Edgware Road currently sits a branch of Marks and Spencer's. It's the kind of place where people who want to be posh but aren't posh shop. Hence its food hall is often stocked with pretentiously tasty treats for Tarquin and Tara, such as Scotch quail eggs, caviar-coated Mars bars, champagne and oyster milkshakes, and the devil's very own vegetable, mange too. Ugh. But before the original buildings were demolished to make way for the A40 flyover, on the ground floor of 266 Edgware Road, once stood a humble little eatery called the Victory Cafe. Although only small and narrow, it was a friendly little place which served simple foods like tea, coffee, toast and fry-ups. And being in an era when most people, especially in a city, didn't own their own kitchens, these cafes provided 3 square meals a day and was a place of warmth, companionship and safety. The Victory Cafe was managed by 50-year-old Alice Williams, a quiet, nervous, but hard-working lady who everyone called Madam. So respected was Alice that when a regular customer called June needed her help, she did just that and put into storage June's personal belongings and her life savings. Both women trusted one another. But on the Boxing Day of 1950, something made Alice snap. So what should have been a swift transaction sparked a fight for their lives and ended in death. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 162. Madam. Madam was very much a private lady who kept to herself. She didn't engage in idle gossip, and she never talked about her past. Therefore, although people liked her, they knew very little about her. Born Alice Elizabeth Davies on the 8th of April 1900, as she spoke with a hint of Scouse, many people believed that she was from Liverpool, whereas actually she came from Church Stretton in neighbouring Shropshire. Raised alongside her 3 surviving siblings, Jack, William and Kathleen, Alice worked from an early age in her parents' bakery at 7 Roberts Lane in Ross, just outside Wrexham. Always being a dot of a lady with curly dark hair, she never let her short stature hold her back, as she knew there was nothing she couldn't achieve if she put her back into the task. By the outbreak of World War I, age 14, Alice was working as a cook at the Shotton Barracks just outside Liverpool. She was young, alone, and having met a dashing private called George Arthur Williams. She fell in love, and within 2 years, they were married. It should have been the start of a beautiful life for Alice, but it was not to be. Disapproving of George, her parents neither blessed nor attended their wedding. And maybe they were right, as although this young couple would give birth to 2 sons, Henry and Oliver, it was no place to raise a child, as with George being a violent and cruel alcoholic, Alice fled in fear, and the boys were put into foster care. In 1925, whilst earning an honest crust as the manageress of a cafe in Liverpool, Alice met and moved in with a labourer called Frederick Arthur Williams. Unable to legally ditch her ex, this new relationship proved far from scandalous, as most people believed that Alice and Frederick were already married, owing to the coincidence of his surname. So again, this should have been a fresh start for Mrs. Alice Williams. But it was not to be. Alice wanted so badly to be loved, but she had lost her trust in people. Her family were gone, her children were in care, and her violent ex-husband retained a stranglehold on her life. To prevent any further pain, she focused on work, and she kept everyone at an arm's length. But one strange and seemingly innocent accident would shape the rest of Alice's life forever. In 1926, whilst working at a German pork butcher's in Liverpool, Alice was cutting up chops with a meat slicer. As the sharp circular blade sliced up half-inch slabs of pig's flesh in a series of clean, fast swipes. It was a simple rolling action with her right hand that she had done thousands of times before. Only this time, all it took was a split-second lapse of concentration to sever the tip of her right middle finger. From the tip to the cuticle, her half-inch of finger lay lifeless amongst the sliced up pig, as blood poured from the unusually flat remains of her bony stump. Having gone to the hospital, Alice had the wound cauterized, the skin stitched over, the tip was binned, and the stump was left to heal. Only the severed tip was not the biggest problem. Having been slicing raw pork, bacteria had infected the open wound, which led to blood poisoning, and her finger being amputated down to the knuckle. Again, this minor disability didn't stop her determination or drive. But owing to the poisoning, the drugs she would remain on for the rest of her life would lead to insomnia, tiredness, and a strange inability to sleep lying down. In 1936, Alice rented a flat at 104 Whitfield Street in Fitzrovia. It was little more than a furnished room, although for reasons only known to her, she rarely stayed there and she never slept there. Over the next few years, although she retained the flat, she moved from job to job, county to county, entirely focused on her work. And rarely seeing each other, Alice and Frederick grew distant. From 1936 to 1939, Alice worked various jobs. As a service hand at the Manchester Hotel, a waitress at the Lansdowne restaurant in Berkeley Square, on the cooked meats counter at the Duke Street Cafe, and she spent her summers as the manageress of the Cabin Cafe in Douglas on the Isle of Man. By the outbreak of the Second World War, Alice had become the assistant to Max Finkelstein, a Jewish refugee having fled Berlin, who was working as the night manager at the Imperial Milk Bar on Tottenham Court Road. And with Frederick having enlisted, the two cohabited in a flat above a hairdresser's. By 1940, she was managing the Victory Cafe at 266 Edgware Road, where she would remain for the next 9 years. Alice was as happy as Alice could be. She had a home, a career, a lover, and a few savings. So what would drive her to stab Jude McKechnie, a loyal customer and a trusted friend? The Victory Cafe at 266 Edgware Road sat a few doors down from the Gaumont Cinema. Being nestled between three pubs, a bank, a men's hostel, Paddington Station and St Mary's Hospital, business was steady. And being open from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m, it pulled in £32 a day. Originally a full-width building, which was split vertically in two to make way for a hairdresser's, the cafe was thin and narrow, with tables and chairs up front, a till and serving hatch behind, and a kitchen at the rear, which customers were expressly forbidden to enter. In fact, with the kitchen as her domain, Alice only allowed the waitresses to enter the kitchen to collect their coats when the shift was over. She insisted on punctuality, manners, and cleanliness. And although some may have thought of her as a little bossy, being a stickler for the rules, her staff never had a bad word to say about her, as her exacting standards ensured that the customers always came back. At her insistence, the waitresses called her Madam. And so appreciated was Alice that even many of her regular customers also called her Madam. Every day, except for Sunday mornings, she worked a 15-hour shift. An impressive feat, given how the blood poisoning would often leave her tired and suffering with insomnia. To combat this ailment, even though Alice and Max shared the upstairs room, just like her flat in Fitzrovia, which after 14 years she still rented but rarely used, Alice never slept in her own bed. Instead, when the cafe was quiet, and at night when it was shut, it was the kitchen where she would snooze, sat upright in an armchair. As for the customers, this was a safe, familiar space for those living in lodgings who lacked the facilities to cook their own food. For many, it was easier and cheaper to get their 3 square meals a day at the Victory Cafe, where the atmosphere was pleasant. The food was honest and affordable, and although it had been a long while since a smile had cracked Alice's taut cheeks, she was well liked and trusted. Sadly, in the March of 1950, after more than a decade of cohabiting together, Alice and Max ended their relationship. As a Jewish refugee who had fled Nazi Germany with nothing, no money, no belongings, and no knowledge of what cruel fate had befallen his family, with the war firmly over. Max headed back to the bombed-out remnants of his home city of Berlin to seek out his missing son. Having said goodbye to Max, possibly forever, his departure left a big hole in Alice's quiet little life. And feeling desperately low, what she needed was a friend. So it's odd that the person she trusted to become her new pal was, of all people, a customer. June Georgina McKechnie was born on the 2nd of November 1930 at 1 Upper Bow in Edinburgh. As one of four siblings, raised by Georgina, a housewife, and Archibald, a shoemaker, they were a respectable working-class family who lived a good life in a small terraced house. Being little, slim, and fair-haired, June was described as a bundle of fun. A good, honest lady who was liked by the girls, fancied by the boys, and who was pleasant and friendly. Academically, she was bright, as being blessed with a higher-than-average IQ. Unlike many girls her age, she was moved from Castle Hill School to St. James's Technical School, where she left, age 14, with a higher qualification. For 4 years, June worked as a machinist in the local factories, drilling, burring, packing, and making the minimum wage. But as a fashionable girl, whose colourful flourishes were a stark contrast to the drab grey gloom of the factory, she had always dreamed of doing something more with her life. So aged 18, with little more than a suitcase full of clothes, she made the leap and moved to London. This was June's dream. But like most dreams, it would only exist when she was asleep. Having struggled to find work, eating only when she could, and barely scraping together the rent on a squalid little lodging at 13 Craven Hill Gardens in Paddington, June turned to prostitution. It wasn't pleasant, but by parading up and down Parade Street in Sussex Gardens, she could earn £1 per client and service several men a night, meaning she earned more than for a week in a factory. On the 6th of February 1950, she received the first of five convictions for soliciting. And although she didn't do any prison time, it made returning to a regular life much harder. But this only made her more determined to fulfill her new dream. To do 1, maybe 2 years as a sex worker, and then sell up. By the spring of 1950, 20-year-old June McKechnie had become a friendly face at the Victory Cafe. So much so that the staff and customers had begun to name her Scotty. Whether breakfast, lunch, dinner, or supper, June was a welcome addition to this little cafe, which many regulars regarded as home. And although Madame Alice wasn't exactly the most welcome of people, between this unlikely twosome, a friendship began to blossom. They made an unlikely twosome: a drab kitchen-bound widow and a lithe, stylish sex worker. As the two hung out together after hours, Alice actually let her into the secluded sanctuary of the cafe's kitchen. And when she needed it, Alice kept June's personal belongings safe. At first, June simply asked Alice if she would mind storing a box of her most fashionable outfits. It wasn't a problem. In fact, it was a pleasure, as Alice had space for it in a storeroom behind the kitchen. She even let June change dresses and do her makeup in the kitchen before heading out to pick up her punters. At around the same time, as sex work was a cash-only transaction and June was unwilling to deposit this money into her post office account, she asked Alice to hold her money for a short while. It began with relatively small sums, folded bundles of £1 notes, which June could withdraw whenever she liked, and only Alice knew where was hidden. As the year dragged on, with June working harder to achieve her goal, the amounts started increasing. But when it started exceeding £30, the income the cafe took each day, Alice insisted that June keep a record of the transactions in her diary, which she did. 2 weeks before Christmas, June asked to withdraw £20. But at the last minute, June changed her mind, saying she was too tired and it was too much bother. By Friday the 22nd of December 1950, just 4 days before, with the post office closed for Christmas and being in the process of moving lodgings, June handed Alice the largest cash bundle so far. It consisted of £70 in £1 notes, £30 in fives, and £34 in ones. In total, it amounted to £214, roughly £7,800 today. For both women, money was not an issue. So what led one of them to end up dead? It was the night of Tuesday the 26th of December 1950, Boxing Day. Having been closed on Christmas Day, the Victory Cafe still had its festive decorations up, with a small tree in the corner, joyous tunes playing from the radio, and the reassuring smell of turkey, roast spuds, and stuffing wafting from the kitchen. As always, Alice was cooking, all while dressed in her usual flowered pinafore and red carpet slippers. At 10:30 p.m, as per usual, June entered the cafe. That night was as predictable as any other. Alice greeted her pal with a polite Merry Christmas. June sat and ate her hearty festive meal. And in the cafe, there were 9 customers, 2 waitresses, Joan Haig and Betty Emerson, and the cashier, Evelyn Attlee. Having mopped up the plate's gravy with a slab of white bread, Alice went behind the counter, as she was permitted to do. She paid 2 shillings and 3 pence for her meal, and then she headed into the small kitchen out back to chat with her pal, Alice. At 10:45 p.m, the cafe closed. At 11 p.m, with the last of the customers having left and the door locked, the waitresses cleaned up the restaurant while Alice washed up and June applied her makeup. At 11:20 p.m, with their chores done, the staff collected their coats and bags from the cloakroom. They headed to the front door, which Alice unlocked. They all said their pleasantries.
Good night, madam.
Good night, madam.
Good night, Scotty.
Good night, Scotty.
They left, and the door was bolted behind them. Nothing was different. The only excitement was that as Betty and Joan turned left, at the corner of Chapel Street, they saw Len, a waiter from the Victory Cafe, who was a little worse for wear and chatting up a prostitute. Fearing he was vulnerable and a possible target for robbery. They stood there for several minutes, trying to convince him to go home. Apart from that, the street was quiet, as the shops were shut and the pubs had kicked out. Inside the cafe's kitchen, with the pots and pans now drying, Alice and June continued talking. With her makeup done and her scarf on, June went to pick up her red handbag from the side, to head out into the darkness, as when the pub shut, many a sozzled drinker staggers into the streets looking for sex. Out of the blue, Alice said, "You can come upstairs with me now, and we can do that." June knew what she meant, as hidden under her unwieldy bedroom floorboards, Alice had hidden her money. The post office was open the next day, so as it made sense, June said,
All right,
I'll come up with you. It was a withdrawal as normal as any other that the two friends had done before. And although nothing seemed out of the ordinary, something had changed. As June went to ascend the stairs, Alice asked her, "Go get the box out of the cupboard." She knew what she meant, as it was a small box above the gas stove, with Alice's savings book inside. But seeing two boxes, as she turned to query, "Which box do you mean?" That was when Alice struck. Without a word of warning, holding the 6-inch kitchen knife high, with wild eyes, Alice began hacking at June's flesh. A 2-inch slash sliced open her left cheek. A 3.5-inch gash tore over the crown of her skull, and an inch-deep stab buried deep into her left shoulder. As the blade continued stabbing, down and deep, with 3 more wounds to her left arm and chest, as the frenzy continued unabated. In desperation, being unarmed, June made a grab for the knife. But as she gripped the sharp blade, it sliced into her fingers and began ripping apart her palm's muscles as she struggled to wrench it free. Seeing June fight for her life, Alice tried to trip her up, to fell her to the floor and gain the upper hand. Only they both fell, hitting the floor knees first, as the two fought dirtier and more ferocious. With her screams muffled by Alice's right hand, like a feral cat, June sunk her teeth into her fleshy right hand. As with her left, she pulled Alice's jaw down and low. As Alice loosened her grip, June grabbed the knife and stabbed it down hard into the floor, bending the blade into an L shape so it became useless. Bleeding profusely, as the blood poured down her face and pulled into her eyes, June began to fight back. But with her energy sapped and her stab-riddled arm and chest now weakened, she began to feel dizzy. Struggling, June knew that she had to act fast. Otherwise, she would die. From the chopping board, June grabbed a potato knife. Fueled by the fear of her imminent death, she plunged the tiny blade into Alice, and having briefly released her grip, June fled. And as she unbolted the door, turning for one brief second, as she fled, the last thing that June saw was Alice standing in the doorway of her kitchen, staring. June fled into Edgware Road, as her pale skin dripped with red-hot blood. Seen by Betty and Joan, they asked, What happened? Only for June to expel an incredulous tale of a trusted woman who for no reason had snapped. An ambulance arrived and June was taken to St. Mary's Hospital. And although deeply traumatized, she made a slow but full recovery. Sergeant Burgoyne and Detective Constable Ogden entered the blood-splattered kitchen to find two knives, one bent, and Alice Williams dead. She had been stabbed 6 times, once fatally in the right lung. With the only witness to this murder being a known prostitute with prior convictions, whose blood and fingerprints were found at the scene, and who admitted to stabbing this quiet, respected woman, the police investigated her story, but when they pulled up the floorboards, they found no money. There was no £230 in the bedroom, just £120 in folded notes found in a disused icebox. But whose money was it? The trusted businesswoman's or the illegal sex worker's? On the 25th of January 1951, at Marylebone Magistrates Court, the case was heard before Mr. G.G. Raphael. With a murder charge and a death sentence hanging over her head, the magistrate asked Mr. Morris Crump for the prosecution, "Is there any evidence inconsistent with justifiable homicide?" Mr. Crump said no. And believing her story of self-defense, June McKechnie was dismissed and set free. But quite why Alice would try to kill June, that answer has followed Madam to the grave.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Whoa, dear Lord, that was a bit of a trial and a tribulation, that one. Oh, let's open some windows. Let's let the horrible sounds of the world come back in. Oh, last week we were lucky because the truck drivers were... It was fine. I think they were away or doing something on a break or something. They're probably going to be quiet now. It's just been really noisy. And there's someone outside with a twat with a really annoying motorbike going rum, 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 because they have a small penis or small vagina. I don't know. Is that the way that it happens with ladies? I don't know. Anyway, it's gone quiet now. Effin typical. So welcome to Extra Mile, folks. I'm going to get rid of the shield that's out of the way. I'm going to make me a cup of tea in a bit. Lovely jubbly. Welcome to Extra Mile. This is the unscripted, unedited bit. I'll dive into some extra details about the case very shortly. We will do a quiz. Before we go, I'm not going anywhere. What am I doing? I'm all over the shop. Thank you to our new Patreon supporters, who are Sally Norris, T. Bilo, and Debbie Riches. I thank you. I hope you're enjoying all the free, all the lovely goodies on Patreon and all the exclusive videos and the crime scene photos, which I don't share anywhere else. If you want crime scene photos, come to Patreon. It's worth it. It's only £2, like £2 a month. It's nothing. £2 a month, but then they throw tax on top for no particular reason. Also, a thank you to two people who sent very kind donations to support Murder Mile. That was, of course, Sally Norris again. Thank you, Sally. And Evelina Westcott. Thank you both very much. It's very much appreciated. I'm going to go and put on my tea. Look at that coffee. It's all horrible and old. It's so peaceful outside now. So annoying. There was a guy about to start drilling a minute ago. That's why I was desperately trying to get this done. Yeah. Three trucks parked up, not one of them is making a sound. Oh, it's typical. It's typical. Well, they've got a job to do, and they're doing their job, so I can't grumble about that. People have jobs to do. Oh, right. Making the tea. Tea is on. One sugar in, because I don't want to have too much, because I'm already fat enough. I am treating myself today to some lovely, lovely, lovely Polish donuts. There's an ambulance going over. There's a couple of nice, really Polish bakeries around the corner. Very nice. They do some really nice donuts. The great thing is they're not labeled. Well, they are labeled, but I can't read the labels and I don't ask them what is in there. So it's like roulette. Very nice donuts, but I have just no idea what's in there. What else is going on in the world? Where I am is all right, apart from the trucks and the lack of Wi-Fi. I'm in a Wi-Fi dead spot. I can't even get texts. It's really annoying. But I do have five coots outside, and when I open my door, they all come flocking towards me. There's one particularly who's very confident, and he comes right up to the door, and he just looks at me and goes, "Where's my bloody dinner?" There's also two moorhen as well. And a swan that comes past every so often and just has a little look in. What else is going on? Oh, I'm back in the archives on Friday. So by the time you hear this, I would have done that. There's two files that I want to get access to. I haven't got time to do them fully, so I'll go in and take pictures of all the files and the documents. And one of them, because I put in a lot of freedom of information requests for files that aren't open to try and see if they can be opened. And one of them got granted, which is great. I just hope the file is worth it, because sometimes you open up the file and sometimes they can be full and rich and like really you're like, wow, this is everything. And then one of the cases that's coming up, oh god, there was nothing in there. It really was an empty case, so really annoying. Let's do a bit of the quiz while my tea is brewing. I might have to stop this halfway through. Right, don't forget, I might balls up some of these questions halfway through. So here is the quiz. Question one: where was Alice born? Question two: what was Alice's first job? Question three: what was Alice's surname before she got married? Question four: where was Alice working when she injured her finger? Oh, kettle's about to go. Oh, let's just pop that there. Let's let that stew. There we go. Good. What did we get to? We got to question five. Before managing the Victory Cafe, where did Alice spend her summers? Oh, I've got a hot water bottle on my feet because it's really cold out. Oh. Question six. What was June's middle name? Question seven. What special meal were they serving in the cafe on the day of the murder? Question 8. What was the name of the cafe's waiter who was drunkenly picking up a prostitute? I very kindly not used his full name there. Question 9. Coot seems to know that. What was the name of the cinema or theatre next to the cafe? He's saying, where's my breakfast at the moment? And question 10. What was the name of the pub which Alice occasionally went to for a little sherry? Exciting. Let's just finish this tea and then I'll come back and I'll fill you in on all some lovely, exciting stuff to do with the case. Powdered milk in. Yummy. Oh, yeah. Oh, there we go. There we go. Oh, get in there. And as always, it leaves a little bit of a sludge. A horrible sludge on the spoon. Oh, yummy. Right, coming back. Okay, so there's lots to discuss on this one. This is one of those cases where there's lots of details in there, but the real question in there is why. It's the motive. Why? Why would Alice attack June? It's odd. Let's go through this. So, in the lead up to this, there was no quarrel between either of the ladies. They all seemed to be in a good kind of communication with each other. The waitresses all said that they were happy. They were talking together. Nothing had really changed. Alice doesn't seem to have done this before. She doesn't seem to be an aggressor. She doesn't seem to carry knives. These were actually, the knives were proven to be owned by the cafe themselves. So it doesn't look like it was kind of predetermined. You know, it doesn't look like she'd already decided she was going to grab it. She just seems to have snapped, but we don't know why. So here's some questions that I'm just thinking. Did she know that June was planning to leave? Because June was kind of saying that she wanted to go back to Scotland at some point. So was June planning to leave? Was she upset that her only friend that she kind of developed over the year was leaving her? It seems kind of... you can kind of understand it partially, but why does... You can understand why June would give money to a friend and a business owner to kind of say, can you look after this? Because she doesn't trust the banks and she doesn't trust her lodgers. And of course, it's illegal money, so she has to be quite cautious with it. But why does Alice choose to look after the money? That's the kind of question that still plagues me a bit. Is it just friendship or is there something else going on? It's just strange. I'm looking at my questions here. Did Alice have any money problems? Well, we can dive into that in a bit. There are bits and pieces in there. Is that why she stole it? Is that why they could only find £120 in the icebox and it wasn't underneath the floorboards? Instead of the 230, or did the 230 exist? Because don't forget, June could have just said it was £230, hoping that she'd get it all back. But maybe it was only 120, or maybe she just made a miscalculation with her diary on the amount she was given in. We don't know. This is all between two people. One thing that I put in there, were Alice and June lovers? Don't forget, this is the 1950s, being gay is illegal. It just seems kind of weird that Alice, who is a very standoffish person, who's had a lot of bad relationships in her past, especially with men, not a lot of good male relationships, maybe they were. And don't forget, this is an era where you couldn't be gay, so maybe. Or maybe they were just really, really close friends. We don't know. It seems odd that Alice would have a room upstairs above the cafe that she never used. It also seems odd that she has a flat in Whitfield Street that she's had for 14 years that she never uses as well. And she's paying for that as well. So why? It doesn't make sense. There's these little pieces. I know that she can't sleep. She says she can't sleep in a bed. But why? What is going on? You can hear a noisy truck behind. This is what I have to deal with. One thing that I was thinking, this is just an outside idea, but everyone calls her madam, and the other phrasing for a madam is someone who runs a brothel. Now, this could just be a weird outside thing, but think about it. She's become friends with a sex worker. She's looking after a sex worker's money. She's looking after a sex worker's clothes. She lets this sex worker dress and put on her makeup inside the cafe. As mentioned, she's got a flat upstairs and a flat that she rents over in Fitzrovia that she doesn't use, and no one sees her enter. So maybe she is maybe she's running a brothel. This is just a weird outside thought of just my brain was just trying to think of all the that is so effing noisy. I'm glad that I finished recording now. I can't concentrate with that going on. Maybe it's just an outside idea, but maybe she is a madam, or maybe she isn't. Maybe she's just a very friendly person. Was she upset about the loss of Max? Her and Max have been together for about 10 years, they reckon. It wasn't said that they were boyfriend and girlfriend, but they'd been cohabiting. So whatever that means. But as we know very little about Alice's life. Alice kept very quiet. She didn't talk to people about her love life, things like that. So we don't know. We don't know. I'm going to fill you in on some extra details, because obviously the purpose with this episode was to focus on the kind of the whys. So we focused a lot on the early life and then the attack itself. But the post-attack has some more details in there that I can show you here. So 11:30, we know that this is 11:30. The girls left the cafe. The waitresses left at 11:20. Obviously, they turned around. They went to the corner. They saw the waiter, whose name I won't mention, trying to pick up a prostitute. He was drunk. So they were on the corner of Chapel Street and Edgware Road, which is about 50 yards left of where the cafe is. It's within sight. You could walk it in 10 seconds easily. So they were pretty close, but they didn't hear anything because the kitchen was out back. June unbolts the door. She runs out. She goes immediately left, and she sees them, and obviously they say, what's going on? She said, Madam did it. I was bending over in the cupboard to get my money and she stabbed me. Haig, who was there, she left because she doesn't like the sight of blood. But the other girl who was there, Emerson, I think it's Betty Emerson, she shouted for a police. There was a policeman, PC George Weissman, who was on duty in Parade Street at that point. He ran over, saw that it was a problem, and he saw that June was bleeding profusely, because don't forget, she's got 6 stab wounds by that point, and she's losing a lot of blood. He knew June McKechnie. She obviously was a sex worker. She'd been she'd had a couple of convictions already, so he already knew her. An ambulance was called via the phone box, and then she was taken to St Mary's. It seems kind of odd to get in an ambulance to St Mary's, because St Mary's is literally like a 1-minute walk, but I guess they have to. As PC Weissman got her into the ambulance, he said that June was very incoherent, but said this happened in the cafe. She said that her handbag was missing, which it was. It was still inside the cafe. She'd left it there. I went into the Victory Cafe to get some money, which I left with the manageress. She asked me into her room, where she stabbed me with a carving knife. I think I must have had a go at her, but I'm not really sure. She also said to the ambulance driver, I went to the Victory Cafe to see the manageress, who was keeping some money for me, which I have been giving her each week to save. She told me the money was upstairs and I would have to go up for it. She took me and pointed to her cupboard and said, the money is in the box there. You get it out. As I was getting it out, I half turned from the cupboard and saw the manageress approaching with a carving knife. She struck me several times with a knife and put her hand over my mouth to stop me screaming. I bit her hand during the struggle and managed to get hold of the knife. I may have used it. I don't know. I don't know where the knife is. It's funny because there she says that she was upstairs, but she wasn't upstairs. We know that she was downstairs in the kitchen because that's where it all happened. But obviously people get confused. So the detectives turned up. They were Sergeant Burgoyne and Detective Constable Ogden. They turned up at the cafe. So June was taken to St Mary's Hospital, where she was examined by the casualty officer, Dr. Keith Abel. She was suffering from shock and had lost a lot of blood. So as mentioned, she had 6 wounds. A laceration 1.5 inches long to her left cheek. It wasn't deep, but it was kind of a vertical wound coming away from the mouth. A second one, a laceration to the left of the middle of the crown of the head, which was 3.5 inches long. A 1/2 inch wound to her left shoulder, about 1 inch deep. An L-shaped wound on the upper left arm, each side 1 inch long. The wound was deep and moved. It looked like the blade had been stuck in, and then it would was moved back and forth and kind of sideways. Lovely. Another wound to the left arm, 2.5 inches long, and another one slightly smaller, about 1 inch long. So 6 wounds in total. Luckily, absolutely amazing, missed all arteries and veins, even though it was an incredibly sharp knife. She had superficial wounds to her hands and palms and fingers, as you'd expect as well. She had a transfusion of 1/2 pint of blood. She needed several stitches, but she made a full recovery. So Detective John Ogden and Sergeant Burgoyne entered the kitchen. There was only one light on, which you'd expect, because Alice always left one light on, which was in the kitchen. In the cafe, the front bit, no signs of disturbance. Everything was kind of normal. They went into the back. Alice was lying on her back with her head towards the doorway, more or less in the centre of the kitchen. Blood was splashed under her and all up the shelves and the table. It was obvious that the woman was dead. They called the doctor, obviously, to pronounce that life was extinct. Let's see. Yep. So Dr. Charles Holmes turned up, and he was the one who identified her. Alice's brother ended up being the person who identified her. It's kind of odd in a way, because he saw her in the mortuary. Marylebone Mortuary, but he hadn't seen her in 24 years, so it was like that looks like my sister, but I'm just not too sure, really. But the other person who identified the body was Dr. Kennedy was the police surgeon. Charles Holmes was the manager of John Jacks Limited. So John Jacks was the company who owned Victory Cafe. When they got in there, the floor was heavily blood-stained, as well as around the hot and cold water taps of the sink. That's kind of where the fight happened. There was a red lady's handbag, which was June's, lying on top of a small cabinet. She'd literally picked it up, ready to go out. They knew it was June's, because when they looked inside, her national registration card was in there in her name, as well as her diary, which contained the sums given to Alice. Also a pair of gloves, a large carving knife found blood-stained on the floor beneath the left sink. It was bent, and the blade was about 5.5 inches long. This was the one that Alice had tried to stab June with, that June had bent. There was a small knife, blood-stained, found in a potato bin, which was half full of dirty water. So after June had managed to stab Alice, she'd thrown the knife. She said she couldn't remember what she'd done with it, but she'd thrown it and it had gone into a bin of half cut potatoes. Also a pair of spectacles lying on the floor. These were Alice's as well. Now, some people could say that this was potentially a robbery. Maybe June was robbing her, but it wasn't possible, because the takings for the day were already there. There was a plate of coins on a small table with how much was there? £1, 2 shillings. £1 and 20 shillings. My brain is gone. Basically, there was about £2 there. About £2 there. Money in the drawer as well. There was £23 in £1 notes, 19 shillings and 10 pence. There was money on the counter, which was £5, 3 shillings and 3 pence. So that totaled £32. 9 shillings and 4 pence, which is roughly a day's takings. So if this was a robbery, the person who robbed the place didn't rob it, because the money was still sitting there. So robbery could be ruled out. they obviously had mentioned they dug up all the, they ripped up all the floorboards upstairs, found absolutely nothing. But when they searched the kitchen, in the back was a disused icebox, which was full of scrap paper, and they found in there £120. So if it was Alice's, £110 was missing. But Alice said that she'd, don't forget, she hadn't rolled up the notes or put them flat in an envelope. These were folded in half. That was her way of doing it. So she said that's how she knew those notes were hers. Let's see what else we've got. Let's do Alice's statement. So upon, as mentioned, she was detained in hospital. She was there up until the 3rd of January 1951. So she was there for roughly a week. And when she was released, she was arrested on suspicion of murder. And taken to Paddington Green Police Station, which is just over the road. So her statement. After being in London for a couple of months, I began to go to the Victory Cafe in Edgware Road, which is opposite Sam Isaac's and near Chapel Street. I became friendly with the manageress, and she used to talk to me when I had my meals there. All the customers know her as Madam, and she said she lived in a flat above the cafe. I don't know whether that is true, as I have never been there. I always think that's an interesting statement of why she would say that. About a year ago, I started to buy clothes and things, and as I couldn't be bothered to take them home, I asked Madam if she would keep them for me. Again, that's a kind of a strange statement, as Craven Hill Gardens, where she lived, is about four streets away. But maybe she just didn't want to implicate the other lodgers as being thieves. She said she would, and I gave her the clothes to look after for me. She used to keep them for me for two or three days, and then she would give them back to me. I always get money pinched from me, and I asked Madam to look after some for me. Sometimes I used to give her £2 and sometimes £5, which she did. When I first started, I didn't keep a note of the money I gave her, but a few months ago, Madam told me to keep a note of what I was giving her, and I did so in my little silver diary, which I keep in my handbag. The police would find the handbag. Whenever I wanted any money, Madam always let me have it without any trouble. The biggest sum of money I gave her was a couple of days ago. I gave her £70 in a dark blue envelope. They were in £1 notes. I gave her another envelope with £30 in £5 notes and £34 in £1 notes in the same envelope. Before this, she already had £30 in £5 notes, which she was holding for me. She said she would put the money... She would put the money I gave her 2 days ago with the others, which she said she kept under the floorboards, under the carpet upstairs where she lived, although she didn't live there. Before I gave her the big sum, Madam was also holding another £50 for me. In total, she had £214. Madam also had a lot of clothes belonging to me. She gives a list of the clothes here. About 2 weeks ago, I asked Madam for £30 she was holding for me because I decided to put it at the post office. She then said I would have to go upstairs with her to get it and help her pull up the floorboards to get it. I was always late at the cafe and I didn't go upstairs when she offered, and I could not be bothered. The reason I gave Madam the two envelopes with the money I have told you about was because I had £10 pinched from me at the place I was staying. I told Madam when I gave her the money that I would probably want it back in about 2 or 3 days' time and put it in the post office, as I have an account at the Marble Arch post office. After coming out of the pictures last night at about 10:30, I went to the Victory Cafe. There were some people in there, but the doors are closed at 10:45 to stop more customers coming in. After the customers had left and the waitresses had started to tidy up, I went into the kitchen to Madam and to listen to the radio. I do this every night I go in there. At about 11:15 p.m. the two waitresses in the cafe left the cafe, and I was left alone with Madam. I then picked up my handbag and I was ready to go when Madam said, "You can come upstairs with me now and we can do that." I knew what she was talking about. It was the money, and she said it was under the floorboards, and I said, "All right, I will come up with you." I was about to leave the kitchen when Madam said, "Go and get the cardboard box out of the cupboard." I knew the cupboard she meant, as I had seen her go to it before. It's at the top end of the kitchen on the left. I had to turn sideways to get past the gas stove, and as I turned round to ask her which box she meant, I saw she had a long carving knife in her hand. Without saying anything, Madam rushed at me and stabbed me on the shoulder, face and head. I was hurt when she struck me on the shoulder, and I turned round and caught hold of her right hand, which was holding the knife. She tried to trip me up, putting one leg out and throw me over. By this time there was a lot of blood on my cuts, and Madam then pulled me down to the floor. She was kneeling, and so was I. She then put her hand around me, which was the one still holding the knife, and with the other she was trying to pull my jaw down. I then bit her fingers and caught hold of her hand and pressed the blade against the floor, as I feared she would have stabbed me. I felt dizzy after the struggle and managed to get to my feet, whilst Madam still held on to me. Whilst resting on the board, I saw a knife lying near the sink. I picked it up and hit Madam on the shoulder and back two or three times with it. Notice she says hit, not stabbed. She then let go of me and managed to take the knife away from me and fling it between... I flung it between the buckets under the floorboards, which is where they found it, under the sink. The knife I had, I threw it into the bin which holds the potatoes and water. She kept hanging onto my coat and loosened my fingers and ran out. When I last saw her, I was going out of the shop. And she was standing by the kitchen floor. Very weird noise outside. Sound like someone weeing in the water. Inquest was opened at St Pancras Coroner's Court on the 29th of December 1950. June was remanded at the Marylebone Metropolitan Magistrates Court and held in custody at Paddington Green Police Station. Police looked into... cup of tea, lovely. Police looked all over the flat for any extra money, and that's all they could find. They took blood tracings from under June's nails and... obviously Alice's as well. Interestingly, when it was announced that Alice had some money in her bank account, Frederick Arthur Williams, who was her former partner, he made an application to try and get access to Alice's bank account, even though he hadn't seen her since the start of World War II. He said that he had loaned her £520 in cash before embarking out to World War II. Apparently he lost contact with her. He hadn't seen her since he left during World War II. And he said he spent the next decade trying to find her every so often, but he couldn't keep tabs on her. He knew about the flat in Fitzrovia, but she was never there. So and he didn't know what cafe she worked at. So I don't really know. There was also someone else who did that as well. Someone else... tried to get access to her money, and when I went into the archive files, someone has gone in and had it redacted. Now, it's weird that they would go in and redact that specific detail, but someone has. Someone has gone in and to remove the fact that someone tried to get the money that was left in her account, the £11. So the autopsy of Alice was held at St Mary's Church by Dr. Francis Camps. Death was caused by shock and hemorrhage caused by a stab wound to the back of the chest which penetrated the left lung. He saw that she had abrasions to the knees with tearings to the stockings in keeping with the rough surface or kneeling, which makes sense. That shows that the two of them were kind of fighting on the floor. Abrasions to the fingers of the left hand in contact with the rough surface. Again, that's the same. A linear scratch on the right brow and small bruises and an impact with a blunt object or surface. That's when she kind of hit the floor. A defensive wound, so a stab wound outside her right arm with the flapping of skin, and incised wound to the left middle finger. So she again had defensive wounds to her left hand when she's been stabbed. Alice had four stab wounds, three on the left shoulder in a downwards angle into the soft tissue, and one stab wound to the left breast directed upwards. There was a superficial wound on top of the left shoulder blade, but the death wound itself was a single stab 2 inches deep from the midline of the right of the back, passing through the eighth rib, cutting the upper lobes of the right lung. Death was not imminent, instant, and he said that she would have been capable of effort afterwards. So when Alice was standing in the doorway, staring at June as she was walking away, those were the final moments of Alice. When they went back, they looked at her blood. Her clothes were absolutely soaked in blood, so she totally bled through. Alice was buried in the Marylebone. She was buried by St Marylebone Borough Council, and her bank account was used to pay the expenses. So all the people who tried to get access to her account, saying, "Oh, this was my money," they didn't get a penny because the council took it, as the council do. As mentioned, the trial was held on the 25th of January 1951 at Marylebone Magistrates Court. It was a quick case. This was the case that should have said, is this a criminal trial? Does it go to the Old Bailey? And basically the magistrate, G.G. Raphael, was there. And he turned. There was Morris Crump for the prosecution and S. Coleman solicitors for the defence. G.G. Raphael, as mentioned in the episode, turned to Mr. Crump and said, "We've got all this evidence here that basically says this is justifiable homicide in self-defense. Do you have any evidence which contradicts this?" Mr. Crump said, "No." Therefore, under Section 25 of the Indictable Offences Act of 1848, June was released. She didn't have to serve any more time in prison. Basically, she'd already served some time in there, and she was released. And that's it. That's all we know. So why did she do it? We don't know. We don't know. She didn't leave a note. She didn't say, "Oh, I'm planning to go and kill June, and this is why, dear Michael, for your podcast in 70 years' time, this is why I plan to kill June." We don't know. We don't know what snapped. We don't know what. Maybe June is not telling us everything. Maybe there's something to do. This is why I've put in the thing in there to do with the blood poisoning. The blood poisoning is in there. The fact that she has insomnia, that she's tired, the fact that she's on this medication, which makes it hard for her to kind of sleep. So she's not sleeping, and she hasn't slept in a bed in ages. Maybe there's something going on. Or maybe there is just kind of the loneliness of feeling, "Oh my God, here's another person who's going to leave me." We don't know. So there's that. We don't know. I wish we did, but we don't. So let's do answers to the questions. Question number one. Where was Alice born? She was born in Church Stretton in neighbouring Shropshire. Yes. Question two. What was Alice's first job? She worked in her parents' bakery. Question number three. What was Alice's surname before she got married? It was Davies. Question four. Where was Alice working when she injured her finger? At a German pork butcher's. Question five. Before managing the Victory Cafe, where did Alice spend her summers? She spent it as the manageress of the Cabin Cafe in Douglas on the Isle of Man. Question six. What was June's middle name? It was Georgina. Question seven. What was the special meal they were serving in the cafe that day? It was, of course, Christmas dinner. What was the name of the cafe's waiter who was drunkenly picking up a prostitute? His name was Len. Dirty, dirty Len. Question nine. What was the name of the cinema/theatre next to the cafe? It was the Gaumont. One of many, many cinemas that were destroyed, unfortunately. And just over the road, up from the A40, there was a really, really posh theatre as well. A really magnificent venue. Totally demolished to make way for the A40. And question 10. What was the name of the pub which Alice occasionally went into for a little light sherry? It was the Pontefract, which is still there today, but a different name. Right, that's it. Hope you all enjoyed that. We will be back next week with another one-parter, and this will be a sad one. A very sad one, so get ready. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.